from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Sanders and Cruz score wins, Sanders and Clinton mix it up, the Panama Papers light up dark money, and the Pope says be accepting in love and marriage. Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders won big in Wisconsin.
God bless the great state of Wisconsin.
We have a path toward victory, a path toward the White House.
Protesters in Iceland and around the world furious over hidden money revelations in the Panama Papers.
I'm severely offended by how our politicians are behaving and not listening to the nation. It's not enough that the Prime Minister has resigned.
Not enough, and with one amazing last-second shot, Villanova took the NCAA championship.
3 seconds at midcourt. Jenkins gives it to Jenkins for the championship.
Crazy. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Sam Sanders from NPR, Louise Story from the New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining me now from Washington is Sam Sanders, political reporter for NPR, co-host of NPR's political podcast. Sam Sanders, our old friend. Welcome back to On Point. It's so great to have you.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. And from New York, Louise Story joins us, reporter for the New York Times, covers business and finance, gets in there investigation-wise, a native New Yorker. We'll ask her about New York values. Louise Story, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Sam, and Louise.
All right. Sam, we could dive in a million places here, but let's start with the Democrats. Hillary and Bernie got pretty testy this week. What is that all about? Is it all about New York? Does Sanders have to win? What's going on?
So there are these two battles happening. There's a battle over who's more New York, and there's also this kind of war of words on who is more qualified to be president. On Wednesday, Hillary Clinton was asked if Sanders is qualified. She wouldn't say yes or no, but she said that he didn't do his homework on some issues. After that, the Sanders campaign got the message that they were implying that he's not qualified. So in a stump speech Wednesday night, he said that she's not qualified. And this went back and forth. Now they've both kind of toned down those comments, but this seems to be the most tense the campaign has gotten so far.
Here's Hillary. In that exchange, this was MSNBC, Joe Scarborough asking about Bernie Sanders and who's qualified. And a lot of this coming out of this New York Daily News editorial board interview with Sanders, where he was seen to have stumbled when it came to details on a lot of his big headline policies. Here you go. Joe first, then Hillary.
If you weren't running today and you looked at Bernie Sanders, would you say this guy is ready to be president of the United States?
Well, I think he hadn't done his homework, and he'd been talking for more than a year about doing things that he obviously hadn't really studied or understood. And that does raise a lot of questions.
Didn't say he wasn't qualified, but Bernie Sanders took it and ran.
She has been saying lately that she thinks that I am, quote unquote, not qualified to be president. Well, let me just say in response to Secretary Clinton, I don't believe that she is qualified if she is... if she is, through her super PAC, taking tens of millions of dollars in special interest loans.
Bernie Sanders, wow. Now, that was, he was going hard and fast there. He's toned it down a little bit on the Today Show today. But Sam, explain this. I mean, he's trailing by 200 pledged delegates. Is New York for all the marbles? It's a long shot even with it, but without it, is this do or die for Bernie?
I mean, from all that we've heard from his campaign, they plan to stay in for all the contest. So I don't think we'll see him drop out after New York, whatever happens there. He's also raising a lot of money. He outraised Hillary Clinton last month by some $15 million. I think he raised $46 million total last month. So he has the money to keep going. I do think that both Clinton and Sanders are making sure that things don't get too testy because they want to make sure that the base can unite come November, but we should not expect Sanders to leave soon.
Of course, we had this morning, he was asked if she's qualified, and he said, of course she's qualified on the Today Show. Jack Beatty, what do you see playing out here, and does that unified base still look realistic to you? Passions are very high in these camps now, especially in the Sanders camp.
Yeah, well, I think Sigmund Freud actually diagnosed this when he spoke of the narcissism of small differences. You know, how people make so much of so little. And here's a case of it. I mean, obviously, they are both qualified to be president. And it seems, at least in the Sanders case, that he was misled by a perhaps misleading Washington Post story that put together several comments Clinton made, such as the one you said, and synthesized it by saying, you know, by implying, and in fact, writing, summarizing, that he said or implied, that she implied he wasn't qualified to be president. And he reacted, and I think overreacted to that. They need to stop that, because precisely she can't be alienating his base. He can't be alienating hers. And, you know, he says, and has said again and again, the most important thing to me, I will support her if she's the nominee. He actually said that on Charlie Rose last night. And he's got to have
the same
more
of him, that she would support him over any Republican, of course.
That's right. And they need to keep that rhetoric to the fore, I think.
Louise Story, what about this interview with the New York Daily News? He was asked, okay, you say you want to break up the big banks. How would you do that? And they really pressed him on that. He didn't want to go to the details. The interpretation of that was that he couldn't, or I don't know. But they pressed him on how many jobs it would cost New York if the banks were broken up. This is your world. Did you see a stumble in the answer there, Louise?
You know, I think the answer is really technical and complicated. So my read on that was that he didn't necessarily want to go into a long, in-depth. It's not a soundbite. However,
but it wasn't a soundbite circumstance. I mean, they're sitting
right
in the editorial board
say, however,
for hours.
You're right. And there are people, you know, people want answers. And he has made this such a central tenet of his campaign that some sort of policy paper or something, I think, will have to come out. But this is a really, really big issue for Wall Street. And so, you know, he may just be trying not to get into the details.
You've got Paul Krugman at the Times, columnist there, saying, look, this, everybody says breaking up the banks isn't even the answer here. And he's a pretty progressive guy. What does that speak to, Louise? Is there, it's been standing there as a kind of truism ever since the collapse that in many minds, they needed to be broken up. Is that, you know, day old hash now?
There's not a consensus, really, on what needs to happen. Some of the people who say that the banks are not the issue are thinking about the rest of the financial system. You've got a lot of hedge funds that aren't banks. Increasingly, you actually have the technology industry, people out of Silicon Valley, doing banking now, you know, lending money. And so, really, the further and further we get away from the financial crisis, the more the answer to what you should do is getting more complicated, because the mix of players in the financial sector is changing.
We've got Steve calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you see?
Hello.
Hi, Steve. You're on. What do you see?
Bernie has to defend himself. You know, it's like a playground. And, you know, he gave Clinton a pass.
Gave her a pass. He said she wasn't qualified. He said it very strongly in about six different ways.
He gave her a pass a month ago about her email.
Yes, he did.
First debate.
Yep.
And that was very gracious of him. But, you know, you don't just give away passes all the time. And it's a playground. You know, we are adults, but we all act like children.
Well, maybe. Steve, we got it. I mean, it's very serious stakes here about who's going to be in the White House, who'll be the Democratic nominee. Bill Clinton making headlines this week. Just yesterday, when he got into it with a heckler, Black Lives Matter protester in New York, defending the 1994 crime bill to this Black Lives Matter protester, also addressed Hillary Clinton's use back in the 90s of the term super predators to describe young criminals.
I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out onto the street to murder other African-American children. Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. She didn't.
Sam Sanders, we remember in the 2008 campaign when Bill Clinton rolled in there with his talking about the biggest fairy tale he'd ever seen, talking about Barack Obama and the big dog, as he was called, seemed to overreach and get real pushback, real kickback. Is Bill Clinton defending Hillary Clinton successfully here, or is he making trouble for her campaign?
So here's the thing with Bill Clinton. I've seen him on the stump a few times, and it seems like half of his speeches are a defense of his own time in office and half is a support for his wife, and that's a distraction. I think that people of all races think different things about that crime bill. We have seen data that suggests that Hillary Clinton does not do well with young black voters because of this, but still does well with older black voters. That said, the lingering issue with having someone like Bill Clinton campaign for you is that he becomes the issue, and the focus is not on the candidate, and that's going to be a problem.
We've got Dame writing to us on Twitter. Black Lives Matter tactics can be debated. Bill Clinton's response to them was as telling as it was disheartening. And the image, as you described this morning on Morning Edition, Sam, of him kind of lecturing this young woman, a black young woman in the audience, the semiotics of that, Jack, not so great here. Bill Clinton sometimes just can't resist grabbing on and making his argument.
Yes, and here the defensiveness is, I think, part, it's a reaction to the revisionism of his presidency that's been going on. It's going on, you know, in trade, certainly. All the things that Bernie Sanders is complaining about were pretty much done under Bill Clinton in trade. And this crime bill, in particular, is just a flagrant example of it seemed to me at the time and does now, it should have really been called the Politicians Protection Act. I mean, it encouraged states to expand prison sentences. It eliminated federal funding for inmate in education. 60%, that's the number of prisoners who rose in the federal system under Bill Clinton.
That's a big hike, and it's getting an airing all the way now in 2016. Jack Beatty, Louise Story with The New York Times, Sam Sanders with NPR. Please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Sanders and Cruz take Wisconsin. Sanders and Clinton go at it. The Panama Papers, the Pope on love and marriage, and U.S. bombs dropped by the Saudis, killing many civilians in Yemen. Sam Sanders is with us, political reporter for NPR. Louise Story is here, investigative financial reporter for The New York Times. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What do you see in the Democratic race? What about the Republicans? Where will New York values come down on these two, Trump and Cruz? And is Bill Clinton a net plus for Hillary on the trail? Are you poring over the Panama Papers? Let's get a call. One more call on Bernie here. Nashville, Hamilton's calling. Nashville, Tennessee. Hamilton, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just calling to say that although, you know, as a voter, and I'm sure the media as well, want to know what Bernie's positions are exactly and how he's going to get them done, I think that one of the bigger things that may be in the back of his mind is that if he can't win, how does he implant the idea of a peaceful political revolution for the country so that he can kind of set a foundation for people to go forward, something that's a little different from the candidates that we see now.
Are you giving up on the candidacy? I hear you're not giving up on the idea. That's how it sounds. But are you giving up on a win for Bernie?
No, I am not. I'm a supporter. I'm not a diehard supporter. I'm not posting memes 24/7 and all that.
Yep.
But I do think that, you know, realistically, if you're not going to be able to win the fight, the backup plan should be how can we set the foundation for the future to take these ideas and hopefully make a change again in a peaceful way versus, you know, a possible violent revolution in the future.
Well, there's no question he has put ideas down in a very big way and an attitude, a kind of notion of major changes being possible and desirable. I mean, Jack Beatty, how do you see this playing out over time? We're about to turn to the Republicans, but okay, maybe they'll patch it up. Maybe. We'll see how tough this gets before it's over with Clinton and Sanders. But you've got plenty of Sanders supporters who are not as moderate, temperate about this as Hamilton in Nashville, who say it's Bernie or nobody for them. And what about the battle of ideas within the Democratic Party? You remember the centrism of the Clintons in the 1990s. That's certainly not what Bernie Sanders is preaching very effectively.
Very effectively indeed, and he's caught the imagination of younger voters. And, you know, really, if you look at it historically, he's got a political machine there. He's got that's what it is. I mean, this
money
this
machine, not
money
least.
Machine. Yes. And those and he's saying, you know, on our show, Tom, when you interviewed him, you said, what do you envision for this political revolution? The Washington Mall full of people. He said, that's not a bad idea. And in that interview with the Daily Daily News, he put some flesh on this revolution idea. He said, you know, 5 years ago, if you had said to somebody, big states are going to move to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, they would have said, you're crazy. That can't happen. What changed? People took to the streets. Low-wage workers at McDonald's and Wendy's and all the rest demonstrated, and city councils and state governments listened, and now we have what we have. He pointed to the agitation around the, you know, cutting Social Security benefits, which was even something Democrats were talking about a few years ago. A tremendous mobilization of senior citizens put that one out of reach. And so he's saying, look, we see what pressure does. We see it with gay marriage. We saw it with the civil rights movement, and we're going to see it, he suggests, with my movement. Even, he didn't say this, but presumably Hamilton is right, he's going to be around, and they're going to be around, his voters.
Lots of response to that Black Lives Matter standoff. Bill Clinton, Jamal writes to us online, says more respect for Bill Clinton after he tells Black Lives Matter to step off, but we'll see how that goes. That could cut two ways. Let's turn to Republicans in New York. Of course, Ted Cruz, in a debate in January, talked disdainfully about New York values. Donald Trump at a Long Island rally on Wednesday went after Cruz for insulting, he said, New York.
I've got this guy standing over there looking at me, talking about New York values with scorn in his face, with hatred of New York. So, folks, I think you can forget about him.
Forget about him. Luis Story, you're a New Yorker. What about this New York values and the way Ted Cruz, who's, you know, been out all over the place, you know, getting ready for Passover in New York, the whole works, he's tried to parse it and say, oh, well, I'm talking about the kind of Democratic politics that have stifled New York. Will New Yorkers take that New York values swipe and look favorably upon him anyway?
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting about being a New Yorker right now is that New Yorkers count. I mean, this is not something we've seen.
Hello,
in other primaries.
Welcome to the roller derby.
I mean, right. I mean, this is I. So I think that, you know, I actually had my doorbell rung in the last few weeks by two different campaign people for these candidates, one on each side, Democrat, one Republican. And basically, they're actually trying in New York. I mean, this has not mattered. So I think New Yorkers are talking about a lot of these issues the rest of the country has discussed for the first time.
So when you hear New York values and Ted Cruz dissing it, are you thinking, what was the Daily News with their big headline, take the FU train, Ted? Boy, that's pretty cheeky. Or, well, okay, we'll still listen.
I mean, for me personally, I feel like a lot of New Yorkers are from around the world, right? I grew up in Florida, you know, and I've been in New York a long time. So I may be different than lifelong New Yorkers, but there are a lot of quote unquote New Yorkers who are from all over.
Well, there's no question about that. The most cosmopolitan city. Sam Sanders, what do you see playing out at this point in the Republican race? The messages and the numbers here and how New York plays.
Yeah, I mean, so as far as the numbers, Trump is way ahead. This is his home state. People know him. The base seems to like what he's saying, so we should expect him to do well. And I also think that any perception that Wisconsin really hurt Trump doesn't really bear out. You know, he did lose to Cruz in Wisconsin, but he still did around what the polls said he would. And he didn't really suffer too much from the data we've seen post that week of comments about Ted Cruz's wife and abortion punishments. So he's been pretty strong, and he should be really, really strong come New York.
Wait a minute. We thought there was a phase change this week. I mean, Trump went to ground, said nothing the night of the vote, just put out that lying Ted press release. There's been a lot of talk about a shift in momentum that would deny him the 1,237 votes he needs at the convention to clinch it. That sounds significant to me. You think not?
Well, I mean, so we've known for some time that there was a good chance he wouldn't get to that magic number. But it's important to keep Wisconsin in perspective. That's a Midwestern state. Trump has not really done well in those kind of states. And he does better with Republicans and white working class voters who aren't that wealthy. And Wisconsin had some enclaves of wealthy Republicans. So the numbers that Trump got were to be expected there. And I think that the demographics and the hometown advantage that he has in New York should serve him well. I mean, we're still going to end up in this situation where we might go to convention with confusion, but, I mean, we kind of knew that for a while.
So much talk about that scenario this week. It appeared to be rather more likely after the Wisconsin results, despite the Sam Sanders dispensation here. I get it. I hear you, Sam. But here was Ted Cruz talking with CNN's Dana Bash, saying that he was in full preparation mode for a contested convention.
We are working hard to elect our people to every delegate slot. I'll tell you, if we come to a contested convention, we will know every single delegate. We will have a relationship with every single delegate. We will have had conversations with every single delegate.
Jack Beatty, have you begun to visualize this contested convention, if that's what it is? I mean, this is getting very personal. Delegate by delegate, they're really trying to buttonhole them now, secure them so they don't run off after that first ballot if nobody takes it.
And this kind of inside game is Cruz's strong suit. New York Magazine had a profile of the sort of chaos in the Trump campaign this week, and they brought out that Hillary Clinton has over 700 paid people around the country working for her. I think with Trump, it was closer to 150. He's doing this on the cheap. He's not investing in these wooing of delegates. He's saying it's all unfair. Well, that's how the game is played in Louisiana, in North Dakota, in Colorado, other places. He's losing delegates that he claims he should have, and partly because the Cruz people are saying, hey, look, this guy is a certain loser. Our guy isn't. This guy isn't a conservative. Cruz is, and that's enough for these delegates who have the option to choose. But, you know, the idea that Cruz is a winner. Never would have the Republican Party nominated a candidate who makes no exception for rape and incest on abortion. That came out this week again with an interview with Megyn Kelly with Cruz. And to say to women, you raped, you have to bear that child because Ted Cruz says so, boy, that's a tough thing to run on. No Republican has done that. And then his main qualification, I shut down the federal government. Well, that sounds good to conservatives, but the other part of it doesn't sound so good. And that cost the economy $24 billion. Tough to run on that. And then his tax program, 10% flat tax, paid for by a kind of national sales tax that would have retired people and people on fixed income paying, you know, lots more taxes than they do now. Tough to sell that.
Sam Sanders, what about the scenarios, potential scenarios at the Republican convention here? There's talk still of a white knight, Paul Ryan or somebody else coming in, even Marco Rubio or Mitt Romney. Those can seem kind of like far-fetched. What are you hearing about what it may look like if nobody has the number that it takes in the first round to clinch this thing?
I mean, I think I just have to say that I don't know. With every time that I've made predictions this whole campaign, I've been wrong. I've been wrong about Sanders' longevity. I've been wrong about Trump. You know, if there's no nominee picked first ballot, literally we do not know what will happen. It's also important to remember that before the convention starts, about a week before, the whole RNC will meet to set the rules of this convention. Mm-hmm. So we still have to wait to see what the rules are for this one. I think our best bet is just to wait and see. There's just so much that we don't know yet.
Louise, you're watching from your financial perch there. Last thoughts on what we've seen this week in American politics? I know that finance is your gig, but it's in New York this time. It's in your backyard.
Yeah, I mean, big question will be really interesting will be if one of these candidates who's not so favorable on Wall Street gets the nomination. If Sanders gets it, what does Wall Street do? They'll be in an interesting position from who they support.
Can Wall Street support Bernie Sanders, Mr. Break Up the Banks and Have a Political Revolution?
I mean, the issue is that a lot of people on Wall Street are not behind Cruz or Trump. So, you know, it's just will be really interesting to see how the industry splits up if there are various outcomes here.
Jack, that's a picture. Wall Street with nowhere to go. Welcome to a new America, big boys.
Then go to Panama.
Go to Panama. We'll talk Panama. Here's the sound of Iceland outside the National Parliament in Reykjavik on Monday. Not happy. And the prime minister there resigning in the course of the week after news came out that he, his wife, the family had big interest in banks that Iceland had had to negotiate against in their crisis in the Great Recession. Iceland, of course, is a big banking center that turned out to have all kinds of problems. Louise, step back with this Panama Papers story. Kind of a bombshell this week. Not a new continent exposed here, but more data than ever before. And just driving home how many people in prominent political office and many, many other high stations in life around the world have dark or hidden money rolling.
Well, it was a huge leak. You know, it's millions and millions of documents, and it showed over 100 politicians or people close to them with shell companies. So what's really special here is the vastness of this trove. It's like a financial WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
But what's not exceptional is or new, really, is what we're seeing. I mean, it's really typical, ordinary for people to use these shell companies. This trove came from only one incorporation company in Panama, and there are tons more out there. And so this is really
typical and ordinary.
I
don't have one. I mean, I don't know anybody who does. Or maybe I do, and they just don't tell me. But really, typical of what? Of whom?
Well, okay, first of all, it's typical for high net worth individuals. It's very, very, very common. But even, you know, ask around people you know if they own rental properties they rent out, then they very well may have set up a limited liability company to own them in. They may have set it up in the U.S. It may not be offshore, but it may be the same sort of structure as these structures from Panama. So, you know, these structures are perfectly legal. And what the question is really about, what are these people doing with them? Some people do legitimate things and some people use them to move illicit money. And so that's the question about all the stuff that came out this week. We don't really know for a lot of these politicians why they had these and whether there's any questionable activity behind them.
Oh, you have a lot of equanimity around this. So did Vladimir Putin. He talked about it this week, said nothing to see here. News had come out that a cello player, friend of his, had a couple billion attached to his name in this behind-the-screen world. Here's Putin in St. Petersburg. BBC interprets.
The idea is being developed. Mr. President of Russia has a friend who did something. Possibly it has an element of corruption. But which element of corruption? There is none. The fact that the establishment of, as an example, the USA is behind the story was already shown by WikiLeaks.
It's just USA behind the story. Louise, story, if Vladimir Putin and his buddies have billions in these offshore accounts, is that not in some sense prima facie evidence of something pretty darn wrong in a big scale?
Well, the New York Times actually did a major series investigating Putin and these very same friends a couple years ago, and they talked about this money these people had gotten. Yes, that's a legitimate concern, but it's not necessarily just because you have a shell company, that doesn't necessarily mean you've participated in corruption or you have illicit money. But in the case of Putin and these people around him, as the New York Times showed in articles a couple years ago, there are questions. So what I'm saying is that the shell companies are just a tool. It's kind of like, you know, if a bank robber drives a car to go to the bank, it's not driving the car that's the problem. The problem is when he goes in the car to rob the bank, robbing the bank is the problem. And so shell companies are a tool. The problem that they create for the whole world, though, is they create a sea of secrecy. So when we are looking for wrongdoers, it can be hard to find them with so much secrecy. I did a big project going behind shell companies in New York City condo buildings, and I had to crack hundreds of them. And sometimes I would spend 3 weeks just cracking one. I'd get behind it, and it was really just a CEO of a company who there was like nothing there. But I had to crack all of those to find what I ended up finding was a couple dozen people who had been involved in international investigations, and there were real questions.
We're going to look more at this one and much more. The Pope, what's going on in Yemen, and of course, right here, the Panama Papers. Louise Story, financial reporter with the New York Times, please stand by. Sam Sanders, political reporter for NPR, and our own Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, 9-year-old self-made reporter Hildy Kate Leshak faced criticism for reporting on a murder for her newsletter, The Orange Street News, in central Pennsylvania. In this video, she responded.
If you want me to stop covering news, then you get off your computer and do something about news. There, is that cute enough for you?
Get off your computer and do something about the news. Sassy 9-year-old, the famed voice actor Eric Bauerfeld, died Sunday at 93, best known as the voice of Admiral Akbar in Star Wars Return of the Jedi.
Admiral, we have enemy ships
at Sector 47. It's a
trap. Okay, there's his moment. And country music legend Merle Haggard died Wednesday at age 79.
I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried, Mama tried. Mama
Always fighting. You can check out our 2007 terrific interview with Merle Haggard at our website, onpointradio.org. We're looking at a week in the news, the Sanders and Cruz victories in Wisconsin, New York right ahead, Panama Papers, the Pope on love and marriage. Look a little bit at Yemen and what's going on there as well. You can join us. Are you poring over the Panama Papers? Are we seeing the way the world really works here, all that hidden money? Are you glad your financial advisor now has to put your interest first, new Department of Labor ruling by law? And what are you thinking on those higher minimum wages, on Merle Haggard passing, on the Yukon women and the crazy Villanova finish? Let's go to Austin, Texas. Carlos is calling. Hi, Carlos. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yes. I just wanted to comment about the Panama Papers revelation that came out. I agree, it's not a huge surprise, the information that came out, but it does kind of pull back the curtain and show that these large sums of money that are sloshing around amongst the uber rich all over the world mean austerity for the rest of us, because if the money's not, you know, in our economic system and it's being kind of squirreled away, doesn't that mean there's less money for going into the tax coffers of our local government?
Well, maybe tax, but a lot of it is being invested. I mean, Louise can speak to this, but so many real estate properties in New York and other high-end places all across the country, Miami, for goodness sakes. I mean, the money, it does come into the economy, maybe not into tax coffers, but let us look at it, Carlos. I appreciate your call. Louise, what about the economic impact of the off-the-books money here?
Well, this is something that's a little bit difficult to digest, but the United States, in fact, benefits economically
because
to some
degree. Because they stash it
here. Yes, because they stash it here. I mean, I spent 3 years delving behind all these shell companies, and I found them buying $10 million, $15 million condominiums here. So on the one hand, we benefit because they come, they spend money. But on the other hand, do we benefit? Because they're also driving up our real estate prices.
Yeah, you
prices.
Can't afford and, you to know, buy anything, anywhere to live.
Right. So it's like, it's nice for them to spend money, but on the, and maybe they hire a housekeeper or a driver or something, but we also need our housing stock here for people who are from here. And so it's a really tricky issue. U.S. politicians, by and large, in recent years have just opened money with open arms. But I think the public is starting to question that now. And these revelations from the Panama Papers, as well as other investigative work on shell companies, has really shown that, you know, it's more complex. More money moving is not always the best.
Sam, the revelations of hidden money does seem to play right into the sort of tensions in the American presidential campaign this year.
It does. It does. Sanders has already hit Clinton over these Panama Papers, saying that she supported some bills that helped make that climate possible. But I think lots of people won't really spend too much time to dig in deep with these things, but they'll see these headlines and see these stories, and it'll kind of reaffirm the sentiment that there is this 1%, this upper class, that has more power, more money, and like just different rules. And that's the kind of sentiment that has fueled the Sanders campaign, that has fueled the Trump campaign, and this is just more to support that.
Jack, I don't know where you stash most of your billions, Cayman Islands or Panama, but how do you see this figuring into really a global conversation now about, hey, what's really going on here?
Well, as you say, it does give another talking point, and more than that, to Bernie Sanders. This is what he talks about all the time, and he's raising the issue of a moral economy, and he's going actually to the Vatican, I think, to talk about this. And the Pope has spoken about this, namely that, wait a minute, we're just not all in this to make as much money as we can and abscond from all our responsibilities. We owe it. Employers owe it to employees to stick with them, companies that make money owe it to the countries they're in to pay taxes, that this is part of what he calls a moral economy, and he sees that as being ripped up by things like this.
Let's go to Jeff in Des Moines, Iowa. Jeff, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, look how it's helped Panama City with all those empty residential skyscrapers along their coast. Mm-hmm. It's the most beautiful city you've ever seen. And when you see pictures of that, that's all empty shell money by everyone in the world. And that they say that they are going to clean up their act. But, you know, it's like getting someone caught with the hand in the cookie jar and saying, well, I'm not going to do it again. You know, so there is definitely, like Putin, the Russians think that there's nothing wrong with Putin having squirreled away billions of dollars or whatever, trillions of dollars. And they think that he's worked hard, he deserves it, and they're willing to say, they think it's all because America wants to take over and discredit everything in Russia. So
I don't know. That's a pretty broad day. You think the Pope's going to clean it up? What do you think about the Pope on love and marriage this week, Joe?
I think it's awesome. I think what he's saying is what needs to be said. And he's saying, like, who am I to judge? And I'm a pastor. I will meet you halfway. If you're, you know, he's not saying it's okay to be gay or whatever, or abortion or whatever. It's just, he understands the world, and he'll meet you halfway to just reform what's wrong with the world. There's plenty wrong with the world.
I hear you on meeting halfway. It's in the language here. The Pope out with this big new, The Joy of Love, it's called, big document. And there, of course, Jackie calls for priests to welcome single parents, gay people, unmarried straight couples who are living together. Be more forgiving, I guess, around issues of divorce and remarriage. At the same time, it says same-sex unions should not be equated with marriage, said the Pope. What do you make of the Pope's this latest statement from Pope Francis, Jack?
Well, it seems to be a synthesis of these two synods he had last year and over the last year with bishops, where there were, you know, proposals made, more liberal proposals made in some cases, that were resisted. And he had to somehow put that together, and what you get is this very sort of compromised document. I mean, the crucial thing for Catholics is this divorce. If you're divorced and remarried, you're not allowed to receive communion, and that's sort of one of the church's rules or dogmas. And he's saying, well, let's let that be dealt with almost on a case-by-case basis with your local priest. He can talk to married couples and ascertain whether they're suitable or whatever the word would be to receive Holy Communion. Well, that is a change, but again, it's a change toward the arbitrary. And I can see a lot of people feeling, wait a minute, it depends upon where you live whether you'll be able to get communion or not. And people were very disappointed, liberal groups, in there was nothing here on contraception, where he talks about, you know, the beauties of the natural, the rhythm method, mm-hmm. and all the rest of mm-hmm. that, but nothing that really helped people there. He does say the church is apparently all right with sex education, but it's got to be the right kind. Let's not talk about just barriers to procreation. Again, change, but change in rhetoric and in positioning and perhaps even in optics, but not really in doctrine.
Mixed message in a way there, not a doctrinal change, it looks like. Of course, religious freedom, a subject in this country again this week after the stories out of Georgia and North Carolina. This week it was Tuesday. Mississippi Republican Governor Phil Bryant signed a controversial religious freedom bill into law. Gay rights group called it discriminatory. Here was the governor's response.
There's no intent. There's no one on the part of the Mississippi legislature or the governor's office that wants to discriminate or harm anyone. This is simply, if they are worried about protecting people's rights, also understand that people of faith have rights.
It would give people, I guess, the right to decline to serve if it was around a gay or lesbian marriage, I guess. Once again, states coming out and saying, well, no non-essential travel here. Vermont did that this week. Governor Peter Shumlin there said not to North Carolina, not to Mississippi. Here he was speaking yesterday on Morning Edition about Vermont's ban on that travel.
So listen, this is what we're saying in Vermont. We're not going to use taxpayer money to enhance the economy of North Carolina and Mississippi when they are actively passing laws that discriminate against the civil rights of the people that live there.
A lot of people up in arms in Vermont saying, no thanks, we're just not going to be part of that. Josh in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. Josh, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I guess I am on the other spectrum. I do support the religious freedom bill, and I just feel like, I mean, if they, I want to know why it is when a Christian says, I don't believe in this, that all of a sudden it's discrimination. You're racist. You're judging. And that's absolutely not the case. It's just saying we do not believe in this. We believe what the Word of God says. It's the infallible Word, and it is truth, and this is what we believe. And
but what about keeping that out of our civil interactions? I mean, you know, back in the day, the Bible was used to justify slavery.
Well, that's people who are misinterpreting then. They're not going by, you know, Old Testament. And as far as slavery goes, Old Testament to New Testament is different. And in the Old Testament, slavery was not, see, this is what people, they take it out of context. In the Old Testament, slavery was not as our slavery was in the 1800s with the blacks. The blacks were very much mistreated, very much. But in the Bible times, a slavery, what that meant was you had a right as a person to sign a contract with a master, they called him. You know, your master, your slave.
Josh, you're beyond my expertise there, but I'll tell you what, if I had to choose, I would not choose to be a slave, whatever century you want to put it in. But I appreciate your call. We got that perspective. Let me get one more right here. Spencer in Washington, D.C. Spencer, you're on the air.
In regards to the bombings in Yemen,
these are the bombings that killed about 100 people in markets in Yemen. These were U.S. bombs dropped by Saudis, and it appears to have killed many innocent civilians and a couple of dozen children. What about it, Spencer?
The civilian population of Yemen is suffering the most from this war. I spent 2 weeks on the ground there in October with the film crew, and you know we saw leftover remnants of cluster munitions with American and English writing on it. I mean, if this is one group, the Houthi rebels are the only group in Yemen that have actively fought against al-Qaeda and ISIS. And, you know, you're going to start changing the civilian population to resent the United States of America if they understand that we're providing military hardware that's taking on a war that's actually killing more civilians than it is military targets. And we're also turning a blind eye to the fact that the Saudis are supporting groups affiliated with ISIS and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
I mean, the Saudis say, Spencer, they're kind of fighting for their lives here, for national security here, of course.
I mean, I'm sure they're worried about a war, and they're calling it a proxy war on their southern border, but really what's going on here is a hugely devastating humanitarian situation where you've got, you know, kids losing limbs, playing with cluster munitions that haven't exploded, and, you know, some of these communities are on the brink of famine.
And they are American munitions, many of them, and we heard this morning on Morning Edition from Human Rights Watch, smart bombs, i.e., they were aimed at these targets. Jack, what about this Saudi pounding of Yemen and the U.S. standing behind Saudi Arabia?
Well, you know, Tom, you mentioned that interview on Morning Edition. The spokeswoman said that the graffiti in Sana reads, U.S. kills Yemenis. How that helps us, one doesn't know. You know, the president said in his inaugural address 2013, a decade of war is now ending. It's not ending in Yemen. And we have supported something like 700 refuelings of Saudi planes. We have given them intelligence where targets might be. We have used search missions for downed Saudi pilots. We have people there who presumably plotting with them where targets are and why, all to advance an air campaign in Saudi Arabia that military people say can't win. It can't affect the outcome because of the facts on the ground, and therefore it's a kind of purposeless killing, and we're funding it.
Well, Saudi's making their decisions. Jim in Omaha, quick one, Jim. Our time is short. What do you see?
Hey, Tom, thanks. I teach here at Creighton University in Omaha, and they now belong to what's the new Big East Conference, which suggests that it's not as good as it used to be after the breakup. But I think this Villanova winning the national championship proves that the Big East is as good as it ever was, and go Villanova and go Creighton.
Who cannot say go Villanova after that buzzer beater? That was just incredible, just an incredible end to the NCAA championships there. One more, Lakewood, New York. J.C., you're on the air, J.C.
Hi, Tom. Just want to make some comments about Merle Haggard.
Please.
We've lost one of the greatest American songwriters that ever lived. I mean, he's right next to Woody Guthrie. If you've never listened to the music of Merle Haggard, I ask that you do that. He speaks for the working man. He speaks for America. He speaks for freedom. And if you're running down this country, you're walking on the fighting side of me, as well as Merle Haggard.
J.C., we take it. We are very glad to have you giving witness here on Merle Haggard today. Very glad for your call, and we do remember Merle Haggard. Check out the interview at our website, On Point Radio. Full interview with Merle Haggard there. I think you'll enjoy it. The fighting side of me, 1969, right here. Well, what a week, and more to come. Louise Story with the New York Times. Thank you so much for being with us today, Louise. Really enjoyed having you here.
Thank you.
Sam Sanders, political reporter for NPR. Hang in there, Sam. Keep at it.
I'll try. Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. I know you have Merle Haggard on loud and proud at your house this weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Merle Haggard. This is On Point.
If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country horse, you walking on the fighting side of me.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.